I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. When you hear about our healthcare system, it's generally about how expensive and excessive it is compared to other countries. According to a new report in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that's not entirely true when it comes to cancer care at the end of life. Researchers compared the U.S. to Canada, England, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Germany, and found the U.S. didn't fare so badly. Well, today, two of these study authors have come in to talk about end-of-life care in America, what we do well, what we need to improve, and let me introduce them to you. Ezekiel Emanuel is chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and an oncologist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He advised President Obama on the Affordable Care Act. And Zeke, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Justin Beckelman, Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology and Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a practicing radiation oncologist. And Justin, nice to have you with us
on
Radio Times as well. Zeke, let me begin with you. Where would you rather die of cancer? Looking at these countries that you looked at.
So I think it's easier to say where I don't want to die, but if you look at the countries, there are some advantages the United States has. The lowest rate of dying in the hospital in the United States in these seven countries, the lowest number of hospitalizations and days in the hospital in the last 6 months of life. But I would say overall, I think that if you look at the sum total, the Netherlands probably is slightly out ahead of the rest. But I also do emphasize that no country is, you know, solve the problem and doing it all well. All of the countries we examine need to concentrate on something to improve. But the Dutch seem to, along the spectrum of high tech, dying at home, staying out of the hospital, they sort of optimized.
How about for you? You must have thought about this.
Well, you know, we know that end-of-life care is intensive. It can become very complex. It can be, you know, discordant with our patients' wishes. Each of these nations has areas to improve, but we can also look very positively on the U.S. We've made major improvements. In the 1970s, the rate of hospice use in the United States was at 70%. We've reduced death. The rate of death in the hospital was at 70%.
Very different, yes.
And we've reduced that to down to almost now 22% in the United States versus other countries that are still above 50%. When you ask me where I want to die in the hospital, part of it makes me think, well, in terms of our article, which country? But it also makes me think, you know, I'm pretty sure I don't want to die in the hospital.
You want to die at home.
I want to either die at home or I want to die surrounded by my loved ones, wherever that might be, depending on the setting.
Well, why? I'll go back to you, Zeke, then. Why, and this is what your study, your research looked at, why is it important for people not to die in the hospital? Is it a matter of cost, or that's where you get too much treatment, or that's where people actually don't want to be when they die?
Well, it's the last one. When we survey the public and we survey patients, almost uniformly, what they say is they want to die at home, surrounded by loved ones, surrounded by the people who care for them. And you can just think about it. You have a limited amount of time left. The last thing you want to do is be in an impersonal, institutional setting where you're not necessarily comfortable. They're waking you up at all hours. They're doing tests. You know, you want to focus on the meaningful things in life. That's usually saying goodbye. That's recollecting what you think was the meaning and the most fulfilling parts of your life, maybe even what you didn't do so well, you wish you had done otherwise. And that, you know, is not optimally done in an intensive care unit or in a regular hospital.
It just, those conversations don't happen, and the people that you
want
surrounding you.
Yeah, it's just hard to happen. And I think, you know, that's logical for most people. Now, for many people, we can achieve that. We've done that in the United States. But for some people, you can't. Nonetheless, I think we really shouldn't be focusing on the costs there in the last week or two. We really should be focusing on what our patients want. And almost uniformly, they say, I want to be out of the hospital, I want to be surrounded by loved ones, and I want to have that as a meaningful moment in my life.
Justin, something else that you found comparing the U.S. and these other countries was that the U.S., there was more use of the intensive care unit in these last months of life, also more use of chemotherapy. So what does that tell us?
Well, so we not only looked at where patients die, whether in the hospital or out of the hospital, but also how patients live near the end of life in the last month or in the last 6 months. And what we found was that in the United States, in the last 6 months of life, about 40% of patients have ICU use, where it was much less common in other nations, 20% or less. We also found that nearly 40% had some episode or administration of chemotherapy in the last 6 months. In other nations, it was much lower.
Mm-hmm. What does that tell us?
And so that gives us a sense that, you know, Americans, we like our ICUs, right? We like our intensive care. We like being able to access that kind of care. We also know, though, that sometimes that care is not as helpful as we'd want it to be. Sometimes it can be harmful. Sometimes it's actually not consistent with what patients might have wanted had they had time to think way in advance about how their last chapter is going to be written.
Right. But are they in the intensive care because they're in some kind of crisis or something has happened to them that would require some kind of intensive intervention, or just people have this idea that something's wrong, I'm going to go to the intensive care unit?
I think it's the latter, right? And I also think that because we haven't normalized the process of advanced directives, the process of really thinking before these events happen what patients want, mm-hmm. that the natural instinct, call 911, get the ambulance, land in the ICU. And we have wonderful, wonderful intensivists, right, that do amazing things. And there's no normative standard, right? We don't know what the exact rate of ICU should be in the United States. But we know from this data, it's probably high.
And certainly compared to these other countries. Go ahead, Z.
I mean, I think it's pretty important to understand that for cancer, there are many indicators of the fact that the person is going to die in a relatively short time. You might not be able to say, you know, it'll be February 22nd, but that doesn't mean you can't say, you know, it's somewhere between 4 and 8 months, you've got a metastatic disease, your ability to navigate and get up and get out of bed is limited. We have pretty good predictors. Again, not perfect, but pretty good. And it's at that moment that we really need to begin thinking about the transition when someone gets a diagnosis of metastatic tumor or their ability to get up and be active goes down. And I think in those cases, if we were just much more active in terms of getting people symptom management and palliative care, having the conversations that Justin mentioned about what do you want in the last, you know, whatever time you have, 4, 6, 8 months, I think that would go a long way towards rebalancing and giving patients what they wish for. And we've got to take away this illusion that, well, you've got a metastatic disease, we have one more treatment.
Right.
Many of those treatments aren't adding time, or if they're adding time, they're adding weeks, not years. And I think patients are often under a misapprehension, and maybe it's easier for us to play along, us as doctors, to play along with that misapprehension rather than to clarify the limited amount of time they have left.
But what you're saying is that chemotherapy in the last 6 months or last couple months of life, probably not effective.
It depends on the disease. It depends upon the conditions and situation. But we do know that there is use of what we call in the field third and fourth line chemotherapy, mm-hmm. that is unproven to actually extend life and may just add toxicities. And that's certainly a big problem.
Go ahead, Justin.
Well, I was going to say another way to look at this, again, is the improvement the U.S. has made. So in the 1980s and 1990s, the use of chemotherapy in the last month of life was nearly 20-25%. Now we see the use of chemotherapy in the United States and across all of these nations we studied, except for one, was around 10%. So we're making improvements. National professional societies who speak on behalf of cancer doctors have identified the chemotherapy use in the last month really needs to be clarified around patient expectations. Why are we using these drugs, and what do we expect really to get out of it? So that last month, that's really the acute period that we have to think about.
Reading through the research that you did and some of the materials in preparation for the show, it got me thinking about both of my parents who both died in hospitals. It was a long time ago. And one of the things that I was grappling with was when is the end of their life? I mean, you know that in hindsight. You know that once they died, oh, that was the end of their life. But when you're in the process, Zeke, you don't know that. You're operating with incomplete information.
Right. There is some uncertainty. As I said, you know, picking the exact date is impossible for anyone. And often we have a situation where we thought someone was going to live longer and they die, or we thought it was going to be shorter and they live longer. But we shouldn't mistake not being able to pick the date with not being able to pick a range and know we're getting close to the end. And there's a lot of preparations. There's a lot of ceremonies that go along with that end. You know, mm-hmm. people want to have their last conversations and maybe confess something or maybe just recount stories. And I think it's very, very important that we give people, you know, some real sense. You know, I'm not going to pick a date for you, but there's no therapy I'm going to do that's really going to extend for years. And I think once people get in their minds, you know, we're talking about months, not years, that's an important transition.
Do doctors know how to have that conversation, Justin? I mean, doctors are really? Largely, and especially surgeons, people like that, that, you know, they're there to cure and fix the situation.
So we also know that docs aren't so good at projecting length of life near the end.
There's just one more procedure, right?
Right. And we also know that when I say they're not so good, we always overestimate. We very seldom underestimate the length of time. We always say, oh, months, and it turns into weeks, right? Part of that is that it's simply hard. The docs want to have hope, like the patients. A crucial thing is what you're getting at is around the idea of having these candid conversations and taking our role as introducing this last chapter as a natural progression of life. And it's our responsibility to be able to help patients understand that this transition is happening. It's happening now. Very difficult to have these conversations.
Right. Let me just make two points. When I trained 25 years ago in oncology, we were, you know, educated as to how to treat breast cancer, how to manage pain, but we literally got zero training, explicit training on having conversations at the end of life and doing things. And I remember two things. First of all, no one said to me, and big oversight, and I had to learn by trial and error, not the best way. You know, when a patient dies, it's an important thing for you as the doctor to write a note to the family expressing condolences, how much you appreciated the patient and all their things. But the second thing is how to have these conversations. One of the big changes we've had in the United States, literally over the last few months, is that we have a new code that is doctors are now able to bill for having conversations about end-of-life care planning. That has not happened. I think it's going to be important not necessarily in catalyzing lots of conversations, but in removing and reducing the barriers. Having these conversations is the hardest thing I've ever done as a doctor. You know, it's emotionally draining, takes a lot of time. You would always prefer to avoid it and do something else. And so this just removes a barrier, makes it a little easier. It's not the end-all, not the cure-all. It's just one step in a further progression of improvement that Justin's already referred to.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about end-of-life care in America, what we do well, what we need to improve. Ezekiel Emanuel and Justin Beckelman, our guests. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Ezekiel Emanuel and Justin Beckelman about a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about end-of-life care of cancer patients in the United States, comparing that care to other countries. And believe it or not, the U.S. did not do too badly. And we are talking about some of the findings and what it means when it comes to applying some of these findings to people who have cancer, the families that care for them, the doctors and nurses that care for them as well. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and an oncologist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Justin Beckelman, associate professor of radiation oncology and medical ethics and health policy, also at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Justin is also a practicing radiation oncologist. And Ezekiel Emanuel was an advisor to President Obama on the Affordable Care Act. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. See, you talked about the fact that now, I guess, is it through the Medicare system that doctors can talk to their patients about some of these end-of-life decisions,
right?
A far cry from the death panels that were so much discussed,
In 2009.
Yes, all of this stuff was bubbling up.
And what's interesting to me, actually, just and this is less as a doctor and more as a sort of health policy observer, in 2009, 2010, when we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, the death panels and they're going to try to kill you was, you know, just a way to try to beat back the Affordable Care Act. Now we get a code so that doctors can bill, and almost no opposition, no talk about it. It just sailed right through. And I think that's a triumph of, you know, really the American public saying, look, this is something between the patient and the doctor, and the government ought to stay out. It should simply facilitate those discussions. If having a code that allows a doctor to bill for the time that it takes to have that discussion, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And I think the American public really wants that. And that's why, you know, we didn't have a whole hoopla around it. And I think that, again, it's not a huge step forward, but it is progress. And I think it's one element of trying to improve the care at the end of life.
Justin, it's sometimes easy, maybe mistaken, to say, well, Americans care this way about death, the Germans care that way about death. I know in a piece in the New York Times that you both co-authored, that was one of the things that you were playing around with. Is there an American way of thinking about death, do you think?
I don't think so. You know, the conversations that we typically have are always individual. And that's when you talk about how do you talk to your patients about the end of life, you have to talk to them about the end of life. You have to listen to them and ask them, well, what are your hopes? You know, what are your expectations? What are the trade-offs that you're willing to take? And then we have to listen.
Is that hard? Listening.
You know, there's a quote from Maimonides, who's like a very good philosopher, who said something of the effect of, you know, as we suffer, let us only see our fellow human being.
And that's beautiful.
That's what these conversations is about. It's about that empathy that happens between two folks. And as physicians have been so inundated by requirements of billing and coding and doing this and that, we've lost that time to spend with patients. And so when Zeke mentions, you know, the billing code, you know, people might say some things like, well, geez, docs just need to be paid for that. But that's not what this is about. There actually is work involved, and there's time involved. And this simply allows for that potential time.
It's a skill. I mean, I think I would make two points. First of all, it is a skill in talking to patients about the end of life, how to introduce it, how to lay it out for them. I learned at the foot of a master when I was, again, training in oncology. We had no didactics, but I was trained by a gentleman, Bob Mayer, at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, who was just great at this. And, you know, I would observe him. Unfortunately, you know, it was a little bit of, as I mentioned, trial and error rather than, you know, here are the elements that you need to do and try to break it down for someone. But the second thing I would say is one of the things our study did suggest to me is that separate from any individual country's culture, you know, and the sort of lore that the English, they accept death, and the Americans, we think it's optional,
right?
And therefore, we're willing to fight it. It does seem to me that the sort of high-tech medicine, the imperative of medicine, which is shared between the United States, Canada, England, Norway, that has a very big impetus here. And it's filtered through the structures that each health system have. So, you know, one of the reasons we probably in the United States have a low death rate in the hospital is it's very expensive to be in the hospital. So the hospitals have found ways to shift patients outside. We've spent 30 years developing hospice at home. Other countries haven't had that same development process. So I think it's a combination of high-tech medicine with the kind of institutional structures that the payment systems have created that overwhelms any attitudes towards death each country might have.
Does that mean, and we still pay, as my understand it, Justin, more than any other country for our health care system, no matter sort of where we access it. Does this mean that at some point we're going to be closer to countries like, I don't know, Germany, the Netherlands, or England in terms of, or Canada,
in terms of
health care? Because so much gets spent in the last couple of months of life, and certainly hospital is, as everyone knows, are so expensive.
Sure. So So first, what we found in terms of costs, which was surprising to us, was that in the last 6 months of life, the U.S. was actually not the most expensive nation near the end of life for health care, especially in the hospital. It was on par with Canada and on par with some other nations. But overall, we also know that the U.S. spends the most money.
Right.
And so the real implication from our study is that, you know, the savings, they're not going to come from end-of-life care. And that's not where we should be focusing. We should be focusing on transitioning our health system away from fee-for-service medicine, more toward medicine that reimburses for better care rather than more care, right? That's an overall, you know, picture around, you know, the economic implications of the study. But I wouldn't say that we would necessarily normalize to other nations' healthcare systems, and I don't think that's the implication of the study.
One of the questions raised about some of the financial findings, Zeke, though, is that when looking at what the U.S., I guess, pays for hospital, the doctor's fees were not factored in when comparing us to other countries. Is that fair?
Yeah, we have very different billing systems and ways of paying for healthcare compared to other countries. Some of the countries we looked at are single-payer, like Britain, where they have the National Health Service. Other countries like the Netherlands have multiple insurance companies, and they bill in different ways. In the United States, in Medicare, we have Part A, which pays for hospitals, Part B, which pays for doctors, and we were looking at the Part A payments, not the Part B payments. And so that will probably underestimate our total cost. Nonetheless, one of the surprising findings, certainly to everyone on the research team, is we weren't sort of far and away the most expensive. You would expect just on total spending for healthcare, we should be 40% higher than every other country. We were not. At best, we were the second most expensive country, if you factor in this doctor billing. So, you know, spending on end-of-life care is not driving the total U.S. healthcare, excessive U.S. healthcare spending. And I think that is an important message of this paper and probably a surprising message to people.
I was going to say, and probably surprising to a lot of people. We tend to think we overspend on all this stuff.
Correct. So we were surprised by that.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel, who's joining us along with Justin Beckelman, talking about a study that they had in the Journal of the American Medical Association looking at spending on end-of-life care related to cancer patients in this country, comparing to other countries as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Zeke, let me go back to you. I'm looking at a piece in the New York Times today. President Obama will sign a presidential memorandum on Thursday, today, creating a White House task force on cancer, the first step in what Vice President Joe Biden has called a moonshot to cure the disease, administration officials said. I read this before we went on the air, and you had quite a strong reaction to that.
Yeah.
Explain.
I'm an oncologist, and, you know, curing cancers is really important. But I think I get nervous about the structure of this for three reasons. The first is there's not going to be this cure of cancer because cancer is not one disease. We now know that there are many, many forms of cancer, different kind of molecular and genetic indicators. And so we may cure a particular kind of breast cancer, a particular kind of lung cancer. But the idea of curing cancer has to be abolished. That's just not going to happen. Mm. The second thing that bothers me about the program is it's not clear what the objective is. You know, when we talk about a moonshot and, you know, first man walking on the moon, as John Kennedy put it, as a goal, we knew what the goal was, right? You're going to have a human footprint on the moon. It's not clear to me what the goal of this program is, making it faster, you know, getting in 5 years what we would get in 10 years. Well, what are we going to get in 10 years? Mm. I don't know, what's the achievements we would have gotten? It's a very hard, what we call in the philosophy world, counterfactual. You know, we don't know. So if we had a specific goal, we're going to cure three cancers or we're going to decrease the mortality of cancer by 20%, that I understand. Faster for in getting in 5 years what we would have gotten in 10, I don't understand. And the last thing, as an oncologist, I'd like to focus on preventing cancer rather than the cure side of it. A lot of the achievements we've had over the last two or three decades have been we've actually reduced the rate of cancer, lung cancer because we've stopped smoking, breast cancer. So I think emphasizing the prevention side is something I would like to see as a very, very important element here, and I haven't heard that stressed. So those are my three worries.
Do you have three worries, Justin, or one?
Well, I take a different view from Zeke, and the reason I do is because, you know, we can say perhaps The imagery around this may not be quite right, the moonshot. But to me, what it means is that the leadership of the nation today is refocusing on cancer.
You think they weren't focused?
Well, we've known over many, many years that funding for cancer research has declined or has not increased to the extent that we need it to increase to make the progress we need to make. And so to me, this is very reassuring. I feel optimistic about it. At the same time, what we need to understand is, what are the definable milestones, the objectives, and how will it be implemented? In addition to prevention, the way I would also like to avail ourselves of the moonshot is to say, well, even if we make these discoveries in the lab, how will they actually be used in the real world?
Hmm.
Will we avail ourselves of the benefits that we see in the lab or at the bedside when we actually put them into practice in the real world? And how can we make sure that we achieve the gains that we hope to achieve for the average American who's not involved in the clinical trials or not involved in the kinds of cancer centers that might, you know, be experimenting or be translating these incredible discoveries?
Well, let me say one thing.
I mean, are you saying, Zeke, that it can't be done? I mean, we were able to put someone on the moon, but we cannot cure cancer.
Well, I think it's important what the it is that we're talking about. And again, we aren't going to cure cancer writ large. We will cure individual cancers, and that, I think, huge achievement. And I agree with Justin. It's a laudable, worthy achievement. And I do think, you know, again, one concrete metric that I do think will probably come out of this is how many more people are we going to put on clinical trials? How many more new drugs and new therapies are we going to test? That is progress, right? The more people we have on trial trying experimental treatments, the more likely we are to accelerate new treatments that really work. And again, the more we try, this is a kind of numbers game, and that is very important. If we can make that whole system work faster, work better, that will be serious progress. But again, this image of we're going to get more in 5 years than we would have in 10, I think is the wrong kind of phrasing for a goal. We need concrete, achievable goals. I mean, it's one of the messages my brother taught me. You know,
Which one?
Ram. He didn't say, you know, we're going to add 100,000 cops to the streets.
Mayor of Chicago, yeah.
You understand, 100,000, we can count how many we are going to reduce, you know, unemployment. We're going to add 5 million jobs. Well, you know exactly what the goal is. Faster, you know, do in 5 years what we were going to do in 10 is not a concrete goal. And so we need concrete goals that we can measure against. And that, I think, is going to be really important for the vice president to do. Now, he's a really smart guy. I love Joe Biden. I've worked with him in the past on very important issues like the Affordable Care Act. And I think he will refine this. All I'm saying is that out of the box, what we've had is a little amorphous and not in the right direction.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, we have a lot of people that want to join us. Let me get Ed from Wilmington to join our conversation. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm from Delaware, and
sure.
I love Joe Biden, too.
Many people in Delaware did, yes.
Yeah.
And he loved his son.
But we shouldn't have to wait for a vice president's son to die to take some big action. But anyway, the comment I wanted to make was I sat with someone just yesterday at the Helen Graham Center, my friend, who has terminal cancer. And I was so impressed with the way the doctor handled the conversation with him and was open and level with him. And that's what the guy wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And the guy made the decision not to take treatment. And he's a young guy, because he knew the cancer was going to come back eventually. But it was my first experience sitting with an oncologist, and I can't imagine having to do that every day that you guys do. And I was just impressed with, by the time we left the Helen Graham Center and got to his house, which was 10 minutes away, hospice was already calling.
Oh, that's terrific.
To take care of him.
Yeah, Ed, it's such a powerful and such a moving phone call that you have made. And I know, Zeke, you want to say something. I'm sure Justin as well.
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, it is heartwarming to hear that it can go right and despite the tremendous emotional strain and you know, existential crisis for your friend, that, you know, a conversation with the doctor can actually bring some relief and can actually be done well. That's the kind of progress we've made over the last 30 years. And again, we shouldn't minimize. You can say that the glass is half empty, but I really do think with Justin that the glass is half full. We've made huge progress in 30 years. That doesn't mean we don't have more to do, but it does mean that we can have these kind of conversations that your caller just articulated.
And you can hear the emotion in his voice. I mean, we're all feeling it, right, Justin?
Oh, you know, absolutely. And you know, Ed, I think what you said was also important around it's what the patient wanted to hear. We also find that some patients don't want to hear the details. And so even before we start giving all the facts, we have to ask our patients, what do you want to hear? And then how do you want to hear it? And with whom?
And those are, I mean, those are such important questions. But you're saying begin with that.
We have to begin with that because we can't make the assumption. We might ourselves expect, you know, I want to hear it all, doc. Or we might feel that for our own loved ones. But not everyone feels that way.
So you need to know.
And so the doc needs to understand sort of, he needs to understand the setting. He needs to understand, you know, what's the room look like here? It's a metaphor, right? What am I walking into? How are we going to approach this?
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Justin Beckelman and Ezekiel Emanuel about end-of-life care, what people want at the end of life, and their study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found or looked at end-of-life care for cancer patients. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. End-of-life care in this country has gotten a bad rap. We often imagine people living their final days in a sterile hospital room hooked up to machines, receiving invasive and expensive treatments. But this study that we've been talking about in the Journal of the American Medical Association, co-authored by our guest, found that oftentimes, at least with cancer care patients, sometimes that care in the United States is better than it is in other countries. And again, Ezekiel Emanuel from the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, as is our other guest, Justin Beckelman, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Andrea from New Jersey to join us. Andrea, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
In 2010, unfortunately, I became an expert on end-of-life care, having both my parents pass away about 6 months apart. My father died in June, and my mother died in December. And what I found so interesting was the whole process of the trajectory of their illnesses leading into hospice. And I feel like we were lucky enough to give them a good death at home in both cases. My father was at our family home, and my mother moved in with me when she passed. And I guess my comment is, it seems to me that the whole hospice conversation needs to pop up earlier in the trajectory of people's diseases, sometimes even with a primary care physician, so that when it comes time for hospice, it doesn't sneak up on people and become a surprise a shock.
Sure, Andrew. That's a really interesting point.
It is interesting that you had the experience that it went well and that it went well with hospice. And I think your observation is exactly what the experts in end-of-life care have been advocating for a few years now, which is hospice has become very routine in the United States. Introducing hospice, as I think Justin mentioned before, more than half the cancer patients get hospice at the end of life. And what we really need to do and recognize as the next big barrier is it needs to be introduced earlier. It's still too common that it gets introduced in the last 7 days. And one of the things we called for in our op-ed in the New York Times was for universal access to palliative care and symptom management for patients who are terminally ill. And I do think that's an important shift and exactly consonant with what you've suggested, which is everyone ought to get this kind of treatment. No one wants to have bad nausea, vomiting, bad pain, or shortness of breath, or insomnia, they want that kind of treatment. And I think getting that to people, getting them feeling comfortable with the hospice much earlier on is going to be really important for us to reduce the use of the intensive care unit, probably reduce the use of chemotherapy. And I think that would be a big improvement in the United States.
What do you think, Justin?
Oh, you know, Andrea, I very much, you know, admire your view and your experience. And I would also, differentiate palliative care from hospice. In palliative care, and what Zeke is recommending here is access, really universal access to palliative care, which he's called for now for over a year. And what that means is that palliative care, it can go along with curative treatment still. And it shouldn't be that we continue a treatment, stop, do palliative care, and then do hospice. Rather, the new model should be for patients with terminal illnesses, start those treatments and start palliative care at the same time.
And palliative care meaning what, symptom management?
Meaning symptom management, social services, understanding what their wishes are. All of this is part of palliative care. That's different from hospice. Palliative care can introduce the concepts of hospice, but once patients make the decisions to forego curative treatments, then you can continue with hospice along with palliative care. So we want to differentiate those two, but say that the concepts of hospice, which Andrew is trying to get to here, can be part of those initial discussions in the palliative care context.
Andrew, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. See, going back to you and something that's embedded in this this study, but also you mentioned earlier, this fee-for-service model that we have in this country, is that part of this cost driver? Is it time to sort of look at how that kind of care is delivered? I guess all care is delivered, or end-of-life care is delivered?
Yeah, it's definitely true that the fee-for-service incentive is not consonant with providing optimal end-of-life care. And in a whole series of other contexts, and we've talked on your show about trying to change how we pay doctors so that they really are focused on the patient at the center, trying to keep the patient healthy, and when they're not keeping the patient healthy, get them the best services they can. So I do think changing the payment structure is important, but there are many things we can do, some of which are just availability of services. Not every hospital in the United States has palliative care. Not everybody who goes out of the hospital and goes home has access to palliative care services. So making this universal is going to require some structural changes separate from the payment system.
Well, we do have more people covered by insurance, but, I mean, we still have, Justin, what seems to be a very complicated healthcare system. People are paying, it feels like often out-of-pocket expenses seem to have gone up, and it's so factoring all that into this, you know, very lofty conversation about end-of-life care, what we want for everybody, but do we have a system that really can deliver it?
Well, you've nailed something that's beginning to be called financial toxicity. So we know that cancer care and chemotherapies, radiation can lead to toxicity, but we also know that there's something that's financial toxicity, where families are, even those who are insured or underinsured, are burdened by the finances of their treatment. You know, I would also, in a related way, say, and this speaks to what Andrea was saying, she said that she was lucky enough, and her parents were lucky enough to have a good death.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. They were. And part of this is that, many Americans do not have the home environment, the family structure, the family environment to be able to support the kind of experience that Andrea's parents had. And so you're right. Some of this is lofty, but the goal should be to make this, available to all. It's a challenge. And it can be almost a privilege to be able to die at home with this.
Yeah, and the idea even of a good death, you know, whatever that means to people.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Talking about an end-of-life care study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, looking at cancer patients, talking about some of the findings and how to apply that to our healthcare system, to our own individual lives. Justin Beckelman, Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology and Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a practicing radiation oncologist. Ezekiel Emanuel, Emmanuel with us as well. He is chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy, also an oncologist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was an advisor to President Obama on the Affordable Care Act. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments or stories? And I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Melissa from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to share, I think my comments are really similar to Andrea's, but from a slightly different perspective. I am an oncology nurse at one of the big teaching hospitals in Philadelphia, and I think I've just seen this firsthand kind of unfold in front of me multiple times. One of the most important things that you touched on from my perspective is the idea of advanced directives. You know, I think that's so central to this conversation. And I've just seen, you know, even with cancer patients who have an understanding that they are sick, I think I've seen times where they kind of look around and they're like, how did I get here? You know, they're in the ICU, maybe they were on a floor and they came in for, you know, as routine of a thing as you can be in the hospital. And then maybe things went south, you know, a rapid response was called and then they end up in the ICU. And then, you know, I've seen people be like, this is not where I want to be. So I would just really encourage everyone who's listening to have that conversation with your loved ones early on, because I think getting an idea of what you want ahead of time can just clarify things for everyone involved.
Melissa, I really appreciate the call. Justin, can I go back to you and then to Yuzi?
Oh, Melissa, I what you said totally resonates with me, and not to sound too funny or silly here, but you know, we used to have these Tupperware parties, and everyone would go around and share the Tupperware and feel it and talk about it and see what's happening. I wonder if we should have, you know, advanced directive parties.
Really?
For folks who aren't necessarily even terminally ill, but for folks who are planning for the future and trying to understand and talk with each other around, well, what are my expectations? What do you think? And the issue around advanced directives, one reason, you know, why even though there's so many resources to fill these out, still, few patients, I think I read somewhere that it's less than a third of folks have advanced directives. Let's normalize that conversation. Let's make it basically like Tupperware, right? Let's just talk about it like, oh, what's in yours?
So I think I would totally agree. We know that there are some communities in the United States, La Crosse, Wisconsin is one, where it has become a social norm throughout the community. And
really?
You can get advanced directive rates up into the 70s and 80s.
How'd they do that?
Well, their hospital system made it a major initiative for the whole community, not just for patients, and to try to introduce it at church and school and other things. The second thing I would say is, Melissa, for more than a decade now, I've been talking about how important it is for every doctor and every nurse to have a conversation, to fill out an advance directive with their spouse or their partner, so that they do have an experience of themselves thinking about this, taking their own fears and suspicions away. It makes it then easier, I think, once you've gone through that process to talk to your patients and, you know, be straightforward. Look, I'm healthy. I don't have any terminal illness. I did an advance directive. And I think it's one of those things that everyone ought to do. And it helps focus your mind on, you know, what's important in your life. You know, how do you want to be remembered? What are the kinds of things so you don't end up stuck in an ICU and say, you know, I didn't want to be here. This isn't the way I imagined it. And everyone can be on the same page. So I think if we started ourselves as healthcare providers, it makes it a lot easier to sort of have that conversation with our patients.
I have an advanced directive. And sometimes, I mean, you have an advanced directive and you see what the person either does or doesn't want. And sometimes as an outsider, you know, as not a member of the hospital staff, trying to figure out how do you apply this to that situation? That can get a little tricky, it seems, Justin. They say, I don't want, you know, extraordinary measures. Well, what, you know, what is an extraordinary measure?
Sure. So one of the challenges with advanced directives is, you know, the barrier to entry is folks feel like it's a legal document. So they need a lawyer. And then what gets into these advanced directives often is a lot of language that perhaps is not acceptable. Not accessible. It's not accessible. What we really want to know is what you're describing. What are the kinds of things you want? One great resource is something called the Conversation Project. It's online. A wonderful resource for folks to begin that conversation about the actual things that, you know, we want in our healthcare near the end of life. As physicians, you know, if we get ourselves into the emergency environment where we don't have access to the advance directive or don't know the wishes, that's a very, very challenging situation. That's why having these conversations ahead of time can prepare the doctors to know, and the whole medical team, frankly, to know, you know, what to do in the event these things happen.
Let me see what Ellen from King of Prussia has to say. Ellen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to say that I had a very positive experience, if you can call it that, with Abramson Cancer Center losing my 25-year-old son.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
About a year and a half ago.
Oh.
And what was so helpful and so comforting was that we knew like 3 or 4 months before that they had tried everything that they could to try to save him and nothing, but they didn't have anything else to do. But they were able to reassure us early on at that point that it would not be a painful death. And it wasn't. And it was so comforting, and it was a team effort. It wasn't just one physician. It was an extraordinary experience with the whole team at Penn, at Abramson Cancer Center, and I will say Dr. Vaughn's group were absolutely fantastic, and they were all in on telling us and sharing with us and talking with us about what to expect and everything. And then we did get hospice in, but I think the most striking part was the care that we got through Abramson.
So I have to say...
Thank you for sharing that. Yes, go
there's
ahead,
nothing say. More painful than, you know, a parent and losing a young child is the most painful thing for me as an oncologist to care for people young who had a terminal illness that we couldn't cure. It is also heartwarming, again, to hear that you had a good experience, that the Abramson Cancer Center was able to make this transition, as difficult as it was, meaningful to you and prepare you well. I will say, Marty, I just want to observe that of the 4 calls we got, every single one of them was a positive experience.
They
and
were.
I think 10 or 12 years ago, that would not have been the
true.
Norm. And I do think it constitutes, again, why Justin and I are, you know, somewhat optimistic and think the glass is half full, that we are making progress. People have learned. Cancer centers have taken this seriously over the last 20 years, have tried to build in and be much more sensitive to patients. We're not perfect, but the progress we've made and the fact that we can get a call like this one, like Ellen's, is just so, so important.
Ellen, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times and sharing that story. We were really riveted as you were talking. And my thanks to both of you. Ezekiel, Emmanuel, thanks for coming in, talking about this study. Thanks for joining us
thank
on Radio
Times. Thank
you for
having us.
You're very welcome. And Justin Beckelman, thank you very much
thank
as
you.
Well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for those phone calls.